Hi guys, this is Natasha, aka Natty Willie from the Nerd Element, and I was at C2E2, and I went to Sasha Verwees' panel. He plays Captain Renard on the hit show Grimm, and I really enjoyed his panel, so enjoy.
You really love me.
I know.
You love me so far. Sit right there.
Okay. Now here's the funny thing about these microphones. You have to press the button.
Really?
Yeah, they're the worst ever because if you forget to hear you.
Hello.
See? Yeah. They're fantastic.
So now we're sitting.
We'll be sitting here just going like this.
All right.
Isn't that fantastic?
How are you guys doing? Yeah. Thank you for coming out.
Hey guys, it's 11 in the morning at CalCon C2E2, and you guys are here. That's fantastic. Big hand for our guest today, Sasha Roy.
Yes.
You always know someone's going to say something because they go like this. I will be your moderator for today. My name is Heath Corson. You might know me from the Nerdist Writers Panel Comics Edition or from the animated DC direct-to-DVD movies I've written, Justice League War, Batman Assault on Arkham, and Justice League Throne of Atlantis. Well, come on. I also wrote the Bizarro comic for DC, so go check that out. And right now I'm writing for Scream on MTV, which will premiere May 31st. Thank you. All right. I am really excited to talk to Sasha because he has been in a lot of things that I like, and I think that all of us like. So I just want to sort of dive right in. So where are you from? How did you get started? Where were you born, first off?
Right. This is going to get exhausting on my finger. I need to, like,
I know, right?
Lean a weight on this.
You know what?
Thing,
we're going to bring a PA up, yeah. And they'll just lean on
just the button. interesting. Anyway, but I was born in Israel. I moved to Canada. Actually, I'm Canadian. You may as well know now before this goes any further.
Oh, man.
Oh, they all stuck around. All right. And
now, did your family move?
Yeah, no, I moved on my own.
I'm age six. Like, we didn't
that's
say
it.
What age.
I know. I took it upon myself. Yeah, I just felt it was time. Now we all moved, and I grew up in Montreal, not that far from here. Probably just a little colder than this place. Yeah. Hard to imagine, but just a little colder than this place. Yeah, and then I lived in Canada most of my life. Lived in Toronto for a few years. Kind of when I started acting, Toronto was a good place to start. And then I moved
what
to
did
LA.
The folks do? What were you
my
from
parents?
A creative background or your?
I'm from creative people who didn't choose a creative career.
Okay.
I think they were functional and they were engineers and you know it was like a matter of survival. Like they grew up in communist Russia and so you just did
wow.
things to yeah.
Yeah.
Know? But my father's a musician, entertainer at heart, and I kind of grew up watching him just be the life of the party, and it still is, and it's really quite remarkable. He's still I aspire to be as funny as he is one day.
And so, what year did you? What was the first time that you got the itch that you were like, I think I want to do this. I want to stand on the stage. I want to perform. I want to do something. Was it something you did in middle school? Or?
I think it was pretty young, but I didn't really respond to it because it just wasn't in the. It wasn't like an option growing up in my family. You
right,
we were very functional, kind of Soviet upbringing. Like, you know, you'd be a lawyer, you'd be a doctor, you'd be both, but that's about it. But I grew up playing music, and that was a really great outlet. And then eventually, when I was in my 20s, I kind of left school, left college, and much to my dad's chagrin, and started a rock band.
And what were you studying in school?
I was studying history.
Okay.
Yeah. Which I still enjoy, but you know, I just didn't need to be in school for that.
And what was the name of the band?
It was called
what did you play?
Tricky Woo, and I played drums, and it was like a real rock, garage rock outfit. And we toured, and we had actually a pretty good run for a little while, a few albums and so on. And that gave me the courage to then pursue other creative ventures. Like, because I think I probably wanted to be an actor a while back, but I
yeah.
didn't really have the maturity or the courage to delve into that.
What did life on the road teach you? Like, because that's a pretty interesting. I mean, that is a prelude to
it,
doing.
It definitely, you know, when you're sitting in a small van with four other guys, it definitely teaches you about personal hygiene. levels of tolerance and intolerance towards hygiene, but it's something you can do in your 20s, you know, but I would never do that now. But at the time, I was like, fine, you just sit in the van for days with these people.
Yeah,
it was a great adventure. I'm really grateful for those memories.
And I think I'm talking to other people that have done it. You learn like, oh, there's good shows and there's bad shows, and what does it mean to really have to be consistent every time? Which is
right.
Was that something that you learned on something like that?
I learned how to I don't know, we had a great time.
Yeah.
It's a bit of a blur, some of it, but we had a really nice time. And I think it actually taught me how much I loved being on stage. Mm-hmm. And that's why I kind of transitioned to theater school after that.
Right.
Yeah.
Well, because in the band, you're all the way in the back. If you're a drummer, they got you all the way
in
the back.
God knows I tried to actually creep up every show a little bit closer to the front.
So you go to theater school.
Yeah.
Which theater school do you go to?
I studied in Montreal for a bit, and then I studied in London, England.
Wow.
Yeah.
Where theater was born.
Yeah. They do some good theater out there.
They do.
Yeah.
There are no slouches.
No, they know how to do it.
And what was theater school like?
It was fantastic. I had a great time. I was a little older when I got into theater school, so I was already in my late 20s.
Uh-huh.
And I reveled in it because it was finally, like, academically, it was something that really resonated with me. I got to be as creative and as intellectual as I needed to be. It was a fine balance. It made sense to me. You know,
yeah.
I was really motivated for once academically because it was something I really felt passionate about.
Yeah. Favorite role?
There were many roles, but I just loved the classics a lot. I loved Shakespeare a lot. I loved doing a lot of comedies and farces and things like that. But I still love to do the stage. I did a play last year actually with Silas Ware Mitchell,
oh, yeah.
Monroe. We did a play together in Portland.
Yeah.
Yeah,
wow.
Fantastic.
Well, this is the town for it. I mean, this is a big theater town. You should come to a show here.
Love to. Yeah,
yeah. Shakespeare rep. We got a fantastic thank you.
Yeah, I caught a show the other night, in fact.
Really? What'd you see?
The Flick at Steppenwolf.
Nice. Yeah, there are no slouches over there at Steppenwolf. They do okay.
I think they're doing all right.
And they're doing all right.
Yeah.
Yeah. They got a nice big place. A
couple of people, I think, made it out of there.
Yeah, just a few.
Yeah.
So theater school is a good experience, and it makes you, now did you come out of there going, I want to do theater?
Yeah, that's all I wanted to do. I had absolutely no aspirations to do anything on camera. I didn't really think I had, I didn't think I had the look or to be on camera. No, I was like, whatever. Like, I'll just do theater. I'm perfectly happy to do theater. And in fact, I still would be happy to do primarily that, but things kept like coming up and calling, and I just kind of went with it.
Yeah. So what was the first thing that sort of popped up on your radar?
On camera? I actually, believe it or not, one of my very first roles is still one of the biggest movies I've ever done. It was The Day After Tomorrow.
Yeah.
And it was filming in Montreal for a portion of it. They were filming all over the world, and I somehow booked the role of this astronaut who wears really tiny shorts. I don't know why. I'm not sure why the shorts, but anyway. Had a really great time, but I had no idea what I was doing.
Yeah.
And I couldn't even figure out where the camera was, who the director was. It's like, you know, all of a sudden you go from the stage to like 500 person crew, and I had no clue what was happening. But that was one of my very first experiences on camera.
Yeah, so there was a learning curve there.
Oh, yeah.
How did you handle that? Because there's a big disconnect between acting for stage and acting for film and television.
I really believe in the motto, fake it till you make it, and I think I'm still faking it. I hope they don't notice. But yeah, I still feel like, you know, in some respects, every time you, and you know what I'm talking about, every time you get to the next rung, you just kind of play along and go, yeah, I belong here, right? I belong here. And you try to convince everyone around you that you really do belong here.
Oh my God, I hope they don't figure it out.
And then you go home and weep.
Just dream.
Yeah.
I hope they don't actually find out.
But, you know, so you just kind of do your best to learn as quickly as you can and look like you know what you're doing.
What was that audition process like?
I don't even remember.
No?
I didn't know what I was doing. I was just young to the whole thing, new to the whole thing.
And to a certain extent, that's the thing that saves you when you're that young, is that because you don't know that you're doing it wrong, you just sort of do it. And I think that what makes people, impervious.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah,
it's what extent, makes yeah. you, it's the fool.
Well,
you know,
yeah,
the fool doesn't know that it can't walk off the cliff, so it walks off
yeah,
the cliff,
yeah,
and then
yeah.
it flies.
Yeah.
But that's really interesting.
Yeah. So that was a great, and you know, I spent a little time in Montreal kind of booking little gigs and doing plays, and then I moved to Toronto where there's a big,
yeah,
Hollywood North, it's a big industry up there, and a lot of production goes up there, and subsequently booked a lot of things and really got going. And that's what eventually took me to LA.
Yeah. Yeah. What was life like in Toronto? What, anything notable? Any big challenges?
Life was really nice in Toronto. I like it. I mean, it's a great city, and you know, I had a great time, great friends. It was really kind to me. Like, I was booked on a lot of programs, and it gave me like the real momentum that I needed to have then the courage to move to LA.
Right. And then what was that like? Because moving to LA is a
horrible, different experience.
That's a very different experience.
Yeah.
What was that experience like?
You know, I still struggle with LA. It's weird. It's kind of like the hand that feeds you, but at the same time smacks you around. You know, so I don't know. Like I kind of I like it to some extent, but I do struggle with it because it's kind of the golden handcuffs. You know, when you're
dying. But you know you have to be there.
You have to be there, even though you may not want to be there.
Yeah. Would you advise if we have actors? Do we have any actors in the audience? People who want to perform?
No. Okay, good.
Well, one guy.
Good.
So we can
say
talk really
mind.
Badly about them. What would you advise people about that move? Do you think it's something they should jump into? Get a little experience first?
Look,
what did you wish you knew?
You know what, I was older, I was 33 when I moved to LA.
Yeah.
And so I had a little bit of awareness. Like,
yeah, there you
go. My thumb's getting tired, dude.
Yeah,
this is
I know,
crazy.
I know.
anyway, but no, I had some, you know, awareness, some. And I had a little bit of a resume, so that helped. But it's a tough town, and I was lucky enough to, you know, connect with some good managers, a good manager rather, and some good people, and they kind of helped me along the way. But it, you know, you just hustle and you just keep your head down and you keep working and
yeah.
try not to get distracted. I can't imagine how people do it at, like, you know, when they show up at the age of 19 or 20 and,
yeah.
and they just don't know themselves, and it's just, you know, this overwhelming place that'll just beat you down.
Yeah, I moved later in life as well. I moved in my like 30s around the
yeah.
same time, and it's really difficult because you realize that nobody cares. Like,
yeah,
you could get up, you could not get up. Like, if you feel like, I'm gonna be lazy, I'm gonna sleep today, and guess what? Nobody cares if you do the job or not.
Yeah, no,
like if you don't make that audition, we got 20 guys who look just like you.
I remember many a morning where I would wake up and I'd think, if I slept through this entire day, hell, if I slept this entire week, would anyone notice?
No. And that makes it so you have to be really, you have to have a lot of ambition and a lot of drive.
True.
Because
yeah.
you got to do it yourself.
Absolutely. It's you got to propel yourself and have a lot of, you just have to have that work ethic.
Yeah, and I don't envy you because auditioning in LA is a grind.
It's not fun.
It's hard.
Yeah.
I mean, it you might have to drive from one end of town to the other. You could be in Burbank in the morning and then have to be in Santa Monica by lunchtime, and it will probably take you that long because it'll be 2 hours on the expressway.
The audition process is kind of like the most masochistic thing you can do to yourself.
Yeah,
it's truly like I sometimes think like there's got to be that element in you that kind of enjoys, you know, to some extent, like tormenting yourself, because otherwise you would never. No sensible person
right.
would do this to themselves.
No one who loves themselves.
You like walk into a room every day, drive across town. You spend hours preparing, and then you walk in for 5 minutes of like, hey, how you doing, dancing monkey? And then you know, and then you walk out, and you have to like pretend that never happened. You know, like, think about it the rest of the week, waiting for the phone to ring, and you do that over and over and over again. It's definitely a personality type.
Yeah. I do what I ask you. Nightmare audition stories?
Oh, yeah.
Let's hear those.
Okay, how do I talk around this?
Tell us the project.
Yeah,
we want to know the project.
It was a very popular and still is, like, show on CBS that has spawned many, many spinoffs. And the casting director for this particular show was insane. And I mean certifiably. Like, there were fights in her office on a regular basis. So you would walk into the office and you would hear things smashing, and fuck, she was yelling at the top of her lungs at people, and people would, you know, like her staff would yell back and call each other names, people would storm out, and you're sitting in the waiting room like, you know, I'm just a young, like, just showed up to LA, I'm like, what the fuck is going on? Like, and just, and you know, people smashing doors, and you go, what the fuck? Hey man, how you doing? Yeah, all right. And you know, she was out of her mind. And then she put me in her office, and then she would proceed to like complain about her staff in full explicit detail for 20 minutes. And then she's like, all right, you ready? And I was like, yeah, I think so. Yeah, okay, let's do this. You know, and I booked it.
Nice, come on. That's amazing. And then after all that, they go, can you do it a little smaller?
Yeah.
You're like, after all that.
Yeah.
That's amazing.
Yeah, that's one of several, but that was very memorable.
I bet.
Yeah.
Okay, so you're in LA, mm-hmm. you're auditioning, you're getting part after part now, and then you get Warehouse 13.
No, I think it started with my first big, I mean, I did a lot of guest stars, and then my first big break, well, I should preface by saying that I get there, and the writer's strike.
Oh, like 2007?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
I got there in the top of 2007.
Yeah, sure.
And the writer's strike hit like a few months later. So yeah. I'm like, here I am, how to write LA, let's do this. I'm sorry, what? Strike? And just for 6 months, I think, the business shut down.
Shut down.
And it was just hell. I mean, I had like all, you know, my life savings. And like I got this apartment furnished in, and I'm just sitting in LA with nothing to do. And so, you know, once that sort of, once the industry started up again, I booked a lot of guest stars.
So what do you do? Like, what do you do?
I got to know my new manager really well. I would sit there, like, sort of, like, weeping on the phone to her and talking. She'd be like, I promise it'll be all right. I'm like, hey, just,
we're going to send you for some web series.
Yeah, exactly. But no, I, you know, I just got to know LA, I suppose.
Yeah.
I got to know some people, which, in hindsight, wasn't a bad thing.
Right. Hobbies in LA? What do you do in LA? What do you do when you're not working? Not, you're not in LA right now, but when you were
in LA, I mean, I suppose I'd hike, and you know, what do you do in LA? You brunch like three times a day. What do you do? I wake up and be like, brunch number one. All right, who's free? Everybody? All right, brunch number two. And all your friends are free. Like, everyone's available at all times.
I will say this, LA is unlike Chicago in that
No one has a job.
You walk around and the streets are packed.
You go to brunch on a Wednesday and it's like line up out the door. You're like, where are all, you go to the gym at like 10:30 in the morning, can't find parking spots.
Yeah. You walk into a coffee shop and there's 100 people there all, you know, sucking down the Wi-Fi, and I'm like, doesn't anybody work? Like,
yeah, and then if you ask your friend, hey, what are you doing tomorrow? It's like, oh, I don't know, really busy day. Bullshit. You're self-imposed busy. What, do you gotta go to the gym and then you gotta meet your, like, you know,
right.
guru?
Well, that's the self-motivation thing, because you gotta make up your own thing, and if you don't, you're in big trouble. So
I read this great article about, like, busy, like, or this is a short story about busy, and it's like, busy is just self-imposed. Like,
right.
You know what people who really are busy, what they ascribe to? They're just tired. They're not busy, they're tired, because they're so... They're really doing stuff.
Right.
You
know, like, they're doing one foot in front of the other. Yeah,
exactly. I got lunch, and then I got a trainer, and then now I'm busy.
I got to meditate for 2 hours. It's going to be great. When I come home to Chicago, it's the greatest thing to get to go to, like, a coffee shop.
Are you guys all from Chicago, by the way?
More or less.
Yeah. This is a great city. Like, I love this city. This is a functional, like, city. It's clean. Like, people pick up after themselves.
It's the best.
People are friendly, by the way, which mm-hmm. is really, like, and, you know, it's shocking for a city of this size. But
yeah.
People, like, I was walking the other day, and I was a little hungover, but I was walking the other day, and I was walking around town, and kind of aimlessly walking about, and this woman's just like, hey, are you lost? You need to, you know, like, I mean, I was really aimlessly walking around. I was just kind of
maybe not hungover as much as still drunk.
Yeah. But I was like, no, just looking at the architecture, enjoying the book, kind of looking around, probably in everybody's way. And so, you know, just maybe being polite. But no, people were genuinely so nice all this week, because I came a little early just to hang out. And yeah, great city you guys got.
Yeah.
Yeah, way to go, Chicago. Right? Nicely done, Chicago.
All right, so you're hanging around.
Yeah.
Big, but you said before Warehouse 13.
Oh, but my big break was Caprica.
Caprica, yeah. Was before.
That was before.
Yeah. So Caprica is
Did you guys catch that show?
Yeah.
I thought it was a great show. It took a little time to kind of get its stride, and by the end, I thought it was fantastic.
I agree.
I think it was a victim of. It was just kind of teetering on that Nielsen ratings. It was just changing at the time. It was like before they actually cared about DVR, and they didn't
right.
really take it seriously. It fell right into that little sort of segment right there.
Because $10 says the numbers you guys got now, any show would kill right now.
Yeah, especially on sci-fi.
Yeah, especially on sci-fi.
So, because it had, you know, like a lot of Friday night shows, a lot of sci-fi shows, people watch it like on their tablets or on their computers, or they download, or they watch it over the weekend.
Right.
Like, they didn't take that into account, so I think they had very high expectations, and it didn't
right.
live up to that.
And that also was the time when sci-fi said, we want everything that science fiction shows. And then you were pretty much the only holdout sci-fi
I thought it was a really smart, intelligent show.
I really loved
playing that character. That was really one of my favorite characters. And it was a great little world.
Well, I want to back up. I want to find out now, were you a Battlestar fan? Were you aware of the show?
I was definitely aware of the show, and I had some friends who were on the show. I wasn't really watching the show. But I caught, you know, enough of it to understand that world. Yeah.
And for the audition process, did you have to dig into it? Like, what was your audition process like for?
It was for the pilot, and it was this is the best way to like enter a show, by the way. It was like a possible recurring.
Yeah.
And you're like, great, no pressure. So I walked in, and I loved the character. Like, instantly on the page, I was like, yeah, this is a pretty cool character. I can't imagine this will just be recurring.
Right.
And sure enough, like, I booked it, and they instantly said, we want to make this a regular. Is my finger still on the button? Yeah, there it is. This is exhausting. You have
I know. Idea. I'm like, so tired. It's a lot. We're going to have to brunch after this. A lot of work.
You've been listening. But yeah, so, you know, we filmed the pilot. I had, interestingly enough, the character was not, they didn't have any idea that he was going to be gay in the pilot.
Really?
Yeah, so I never played him with any of that in mind. And only after I was picked up as a regular, after the pilot was picked up, did they mention that. I'm like, I'm sorry, what? Did you see what, I just killed that guy's gay? I was like, okay. And because, you know, like, it didn't really, I thought it was a great movie.
It's a great call.
And a great call.
Really
enriched it. I thought they handled it beautifully, and I was really proud to play that. But it was just kind of shocking to put that, you know, it's an afterthought. Like,
right.
Why don't we just tack that onto your character?
And what did they say about that? Was it just something that they were maybe in the back of their head that they were playing with, or?
I think, you know, Jane Espenson, you guys are a fan.
Yeah.
She's amazing. She's
fantastic.
Fantastic writer, a great friend, and she is a big fan of the LGBT community, and so she wanted to put that into the show. And I thought it was great. I was just concerned that, like, did I need to do something like that? Pilot, like, we already shot all that, and she said no, because in this world it's a non-issue, which made it so fascinating to play a character who's gay in a world that doesn't care about sexuality,
right,
cares about race or where you come from, but for some reason sexuality doesn't matter. And it was really interesting to see how it would play out in a world like that. Like, it was just, you know, such a non-issue that it was kind of lovely to
play That's actually really cool. So you get the part, you find out you're reoccurring. Mm-hmm. What were your biggest challenges with this character? Like, you talked about a little bit about what you obviously connected to right off the page. Were there aspects of the character that you were like, I gotta dig to sort of find this aspect of him? Like the violence?
The violence, definitely. Uh-huh. Yeah, he was brutal.
Yeah.
Which was amazing, because he was also a family man and a married man. And, you know, so there's all these levels to this character, which made it so much fun to play. And, but I definitely related to some of the struggles that he was going through, like the idea of, you know, assimilating into a culture that's not your own, and being an immigrant and all that stuff. That sort of resonated with my family. And so, yeah, so that was definitely something I connected to.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And then any stories you want to tell us from the filming that can, a little behind the scenes? Did you guys have a good time?
We had a great time, and
we're
still good friends with a lot of those people. It filmed in Vancouver.
Okay, so you got to go back to
Canada. Beautiful city. Yeah,
beautiful city.
And it was a great cast. Eric Stoltz and Issa Morales, Paul Alkinson, like, just amazing people. Polly Walker. Yeah, I learned a lot watching them. They were amazing actors. Some good friends.
All right, so from there, your sci-fi is Golden Boy at that point, and you get to go to Warehouse 13.
Yeah.
They wanted to keep you in the family.
They did keep me in the family. It was nice. That was a great group of people, too.
Yeah. And that was a really fun show.
That
was really fun, lively, bouncy show.
Yeah, like, Eddie and Joanne, and like, we had a great time. Yeah. And Saul, and yeah, we, it was a really fun season.
Was that an easy experience? Because they clearly, the execs knew who you were, and they were aware. They were like, hey, why don't we walk you right over here?
That's kind of how it was.
Yeah.
Yeah, and it was, you know, very flattering, and it was fun. And I got to go to Toronto. It's funny, you book all these things, and then they send you back to Canada.
That's right.
It was a great time. I did a season of that show, and really warm, wonderful family.
What was the big differences between that and Caprica? Because, I mean,
well, Caprica had no laughs. I mean, it was just so serious. So, you know, like... this one, you know, there's just like Jack Kenny, who was a showrunner, is just the funniest guy on earth. And so, like, it was just this, you know, sensibility, this comic sensibility to the whole show and the people involved. So it was a lot lighter and it was a lot of fun.
Yeah. And then, how long between when that ended and Grimm?
Gosh, you know what? I think it was right on the heels of that.
Great.
Yeah, that Grimm happened. So,
and what was that audition experience?
That was really funny. You guys Grimm fans? You guys want
to? Yeah.
Thank you. And that was really funny. You know, I first auditioned for Monroe, which wasn't like quite as comical as, you know, I got silent. I was like, oh, yeah, okay. Yeah,
oh, that makes sense.
Well, that's the best of me. But because at the time, I think they were just kind of like, I don't know, they had a different kind of approach to him. And then Jim Calf, one of our showrunners, he had done a movie with Silas, and he's like, you know who? And they just sought him out, and thank God they did. And then they brought me in for the police captain subsequently, and I couldn't understand for the life of me what? And like, because in the pilot, he's got a couple lines, and he reads so much older, I thought. And I just remember, like, on the day, like, when I showed up to read for it, it was like a room full of everybody. I mean, it was like women were reading for it, and, you know, like every demographic and age range. And I was sitting there,
so they way had no idea.
And I was like, what am I doing? And they wanted him to be British. I mean, they were all over the map with this guy. And I was like, what am I doing? And I remember calling my manager going, I honestly think they called me in for like the wrong role. I have no idea. From the audition room, I actually called him, like, this was a huge waste of time. And so I went in, and it's because I was so fed up. It was at the end of pilot season, and I like tested for several projects, and I was just exhausted. If you guys are aware of what pilot season is, it's like January to April, where all the new pilots are filmed and all the new casting happens, and they put actors through the ringer.
They just grind them.
Because you're going out like three times a day for auditions, and then if they like you, you go back for a callback, and if they like you, you go back for a studio test, and if they like that, you go back for a network test, and it's like, they kill you. And so I had gone through so much.
And you can't actually audition until you make the deal.
Right, and you have to make the deal. Like, if you're testing for a role, if you're really one of the contenders, like the last two, three people, they make you sign the deal. So you know, like, the money that you're going to get, you know how your life's going to change.
They sign it for 5 years.
Here you go, okay, now perform. And you're like, you know.
It's like going to a job interview, and on the final round, they're like, okay, if we hire you, and we're hiring you exclusively, here's everything that's going to happen, and we're locking you in.
Yeah.
And you're going, what if I don't get this job? They're like,
there's the door.
There's the door.
So,
brutal.
So I was at the very tail end of the pilot season, and I was so fed up at that point. And I was sitting in this audition room thinking, why are they wasting my time? They clearly don't know what they're doing and who they're looking for. And so I walked in, and I think it was that attitude of like, fuck off, whatever. Let's just get this thing.
That's our guy.
Because when you don't care, they love you. It's like any dysfunctional relationship. The second you're like, I'm out of here, like, no, come back. You know? What auditioning is like. If you want to book a role in Hollywood, just act like you're the most disinterested boyfriend ever. Whatever, I'll be in the car. I love him.
What's that guy who hates us?
I know, he's so intriguing.
He's so interesting.
He so doesn't want this job. Bring him back.
Let's make him go to Portland for 5 years.
So somehow I booked it, and they actually, I got to Portland, never been to Portland before. and never thought the show would go. I was like, well, let's make the most of it. Let's have like 3 weeks here and just eat everything and just hang out, and then, you know, we'll never be here again. 5 years later. Yeah.
So, and did it surprise you what eventually the character evolved into?
It did. I mean, they spoke to me of what they wanted him to become. Okay. And, you know,
when? Year one?
In the pilot. Because I had my doubts about the whole English thing. I was like, this sounds a little too, you know, James Bondy, kind of like, you know, like, that Mr. Grimm. And it's like, you know, like, it just, and so I kind of was telling them, hey, you know, I speak these other languages, maybe we could utilize, and I'm like, oh, that's interesting, yeah, maybe we'll utilize some of that.
Right.
And sure enough, you know, they did away with the dialect, and then made him this polyglot who's just constantly talking in all these different languages. And you know, bless them, like Jim Kauf and David Greenwald, great showrunners. You probably know them from like Angel and Buffy. And, they work really organically. Like they recognize who you are, what your strengths are, and they play to that. They write to that.
That's great. Yeah. And you hear that a lot. When I was talking to the Lost Girls, they were saying how the characters sort of lean into their strengths, and that's really where a show takes off and where you can really connect to a character, because like you said, the showrunners are aware of who you are and they go, oh, we can play all these things that you can do.
Absolutely. I think for, you know, a show to really be successful, I mean, it takes so many moving parts, you know, it's really hard to recreate that. If they could, they would every single season recreate it with hit shows, obviously. But
right. But
it's, you know, it's like a zeitgeist, like, you know, like you're at the right place at the right time with the right audience waiting for it, and it all kind of comes together. But one of the things that you need to have, and we had it, for instance, with the relationship with Silas and David, you know, the Grimm and Monroe, right from the pilot, you got a sense of these people.
Right.
They were really strong in those roles. You know, like the kind of young, wide-eyed guy who has no idea, you know, what he's inheriting, and this kind of seasoned vessel creature who's like, you know, like Silas really inhabited the role right from the beginning. And I think to some extent the rest of us had to catch up, you know, because they had those two characters really ironed out.
Yeah.
And then, you know, subsequently they got to know the rest of the cast and got to start writing for us as well. And play to our strengths, which I think is what you need to do on a hit show or a good show, is the writers recognize who you are after a time. They get to know you, and they start to kind of bring elements of your personality or your strengths into it to enrich it. And I think it happens with every great show.
Right. Favorite episodes? Least favorite episodes to have shot?
You know, it's such a blur. Like, it's almost like we hit 100 episodes recently, and it's almost like you've done like one 100-hour episode.
Right.
Like, it just feels like that. Like, it never stopped going. I'm just like, it's all fine. I have no idea which season and which episode is what. But, you know, when they started to write for Renard and they started to make him more layered, bring in certain levels of, like, family, you got to know that he was, like, this bastard son, and he had a backstory, and there was reason for the way he behaved, and there was reason for this character and his motivations. And it enriched the character. That's when it got really interesting for me, and I'm sure for audiences too, because it's fun to have a baddie, but it's really fun to understand and sympathize with the baddie, because you're like, oh, okay, I get it now. It's not just out of a vacuum. He's not just a prick. He's actually, like, he's got a chip on his shoulder because things happen to him, you know, and we can recognize that. You know, we can recognize those faults in ourselves.
Right. You guys, I'm gonna open it up to questions, so I'm gonna ask you guys to make your way to this Q&A mic if you have questions, and I'm sure you do. But I do wanna ask, what were you unprepared for to work on a science fiction effects show? Like, are there unique things that you go, and we're waiting for 3 hours for them to do the makeup on this?
It is so weird what our normal is. Like, the other day I'm sitting with Claire Coffey and we're both naked.
And you get paid for this job.
And it's first thing in the morning. I'm like, hey Claire, what's up? And she's like nursing her baby. She's got this brand new baby, and she's like nursing, like a real baby, not a set baby, because I know she's giving birth a lot on set too. Her actual baby. Very fertile woman, Miss Coffey. But anyway, and she's like, hey, what's up? And she's going through my like, all right. And I just kind of strip down, and she's sort of like, and then we're, you know, there's some makeout scene or something like that, and then I kind of look at her, and it's like, you know, it's 10:30 in the morning, and this is what we do for a living. Yep. And like, it's just so, but it's so our normal, you know, or I'm,
right.
I'm coming to work and I have to step over all these corpses strewn all over the set because we had some giant murder scene and Nick probably, you know, impaled somebody or something.
Right.
And I'm like, oh man, hey, good morning. Whoops, don't check for that. It's and it's just, that's your new normal, you know, and it's really fun and ridiculous.
That's amazing. Yeah. Anything you want to spoil or tell us about coming up?
Hey, I'm looking out for you guys.
Someone was
there. There's going to be, because a lot of people always asking about Zauberbeasts, what are they and all that. There's going to be a full-blown, badass, really powerful Zauberbeast coming up. And you're going to see like how nasty they are. And Renard is going to get a little darker.
Uh-oh.
Oh.
Which I petitioned for like two seasons. I was like, enough of this. He's like, really too nice. He's too predictable. Like, bring him back. Bring him back to the dark side.
Really? And were they open to that?
Yeah.
I mean, clearly they were. Yeah. They're talking about it.
Yeah, no, they are receptive. But I think that's the beauty of this character. I love these characters. Like, Sam Adamo is like that. Like, really interesting characters for me are characters that are unpredictable, just like human beings, and that they, it's not about loyalties, it's not about anything, it's about them. It's like, yeah. We are all inherently somewhat selfish, or, you know, we have like our own best interests in mind. And you just, you know, I find that really fascinating because as long as it's properly motivated, I'll go with it, you know. I mean, I love anti-heroes. I love people who are unpredictable, or characters that are unpredictable. Not people, I don't want those people in my life. But how to play on TV? Yeah, absolutely, I'll take it.
How far, if you were writing the fan fiction, how far do you want Renard to go? Like, what in your mind, where would you like to see that character to play?
Oh, I mean, he's Richard III for me. Like,
yeah?
He's nasty. Like, I proposed some weird shit. They're like, oh, that's really good. That's really dark. That's, like, I was talking about, like, killing off a baby. Like, I was like, no, because that's what Richard III would do. He's
yeah.
like, no other lineage is going to interfere with mine, you know? And like, I was like, go, man, go dark, I don't care. But like, they're obviously not gonna, you know.
Right. Not in prime time, we're not killing
him. But just, you know, like killing puppies and stuff. He's not like that. He's got other things to do.
That sounds cool.
but yes, he's gonna shift a little bit.
All right, let's go over here to our questions. Give us your name and your question.
Christy, and Sasha, you do such an amazing job as the captain, especially you bring a level of sophistication to it that I can't see Silas. Like, I think Silas would be more like Columbo than if he was the captain than you, because you just wear that suit and that overcoat really well.
Thank you.
But I just wanted to ask, so the royal family is gone, the council is gone, do you think they'll ever go with that? Because I thought the keys, you know, that was first season, and then, you know, they went in a different storyline, so I thought, oh, we'll never hear about the keys again, and all of a sudden the keys are back.
Mm-hmm.
So I was wondering if they'll ever pick up the royal family again, or the council.
I don't know about the council, the royal family. I think there's maybe some resonance, like, I mean, some residuals left in regards to the royal family, because there are characters out there, you know, from that line. And I think, you know, as long as Renard's around, there is a certain royal aspect to it. Like, you know, there's all this Black Claw stuff going on right now, where all the vets are uprising, and they're all coming to him. Well, they're coming to him because they know of his lineage, they know of his sort of, you know, reputation. And so I think it'll continue to play. But they're trying to tie up all those loose stories, you know, they've certainly gone on many tangents, and they're trying to answer a lot of those storylines, especially as we're getting, you know, like, it's season number 5, like, I don't know how many more seasons we have, we need to kind of wrap up some stories. So, so I don't know about specifics, but I think there'll be a little residual of the royal family still around.
Great, thank you.
Yeah.
Good question. Nicely done.
Yeah.
You can clap it up. There you go, Christy. Hi, what's your name and your question?
Hi, my name is Bonnie.
Hi, Bonnie.
First of all, I want to say I do think you play an excellent role as the captain.
Thank you.
I do like the multi-layers, and like you said, I like the whole transition. You know, he kind of was a bad guy, and he kind of goes, well, maybe he's like more neutral good, and he's going to play nice, but now he's going to go darker, and we're going to see the true side of his heritage and what he's going for.
Right.
So I like that aspect.
Thank you.
My question for you on a personal level, though, is, currently mostly on these sci-fi fantasy kind of things with Grimm, do you feel that you might become pigeonholed in those kinds of categories, Because I know that seems to happen for a lot of actors, and are you kind of hoping at some point to branch out into more non-science fiction?
Oh, absolutely, yeah. Thanks for asking.
That's a really good question.
It's really hard when you're a big guy not to get cast in this sort of commanding or bad guy roles. Like, it reads a lot on my resume. Like, it's just this bad guy, that bad guy, you know? Because it's easy, and sometimes casting gets a little lazy, and they're like, oh, he did that there, let's have him do it here. So it is up to me and my team to like try to seek out roles that'll be different from that. I personally I like to do comedy, and I come out of a lot of comedic stuff. You never know by my resume, but I have done comedy, and I used to, you know, I still do a little posting and stand up and all that kind of stuff, but. Some voiceover, but like I definitely want to get away from it. As much as I enjoy it, I think I've done enough of it, and I'd like to get a little, you know, depart from that a little bit now. But yes, it's definitely on my mind.
Oh, awesome! Thank you.
Yeah,
that's a good question. Thank you.
Yeah, I actually meant to bring up your two-part It's Always Sunny that you did on that, and that was hysterical.
I was a huge fan of that show.
How did you get involved with that, with those guys?
I auditioned for those guys, and you know, it was a great two-part episode. Like, I actually, it was one of the few times, I read a lot of scripts, especially when you're auditioning, and I read a lot of comedy scripts, and it was just... But this one was like, I read the script and I was laughing my head off, like, because it was just so fun. I don't know if you guys are Always Sunny fans, but I was a fan, you know, and I did the show, and I had a great time.
Yeah. They're crazy.
They're great.
And they're in their own bubble, like, they which is fantastic.
Yeah,
they can do their own, they can go as far as they want.
Yeah.
Hi, what's your name and what's your question?
My name is Michaela. I had a question about Renard. What do you think the end game for him would be, as far as like maybe him taking a possible leadership role? Would he maybe try to not exactly resurrect, but capitalize on his bloodline? Anything, even locally?
Right.
That's interesting. I think he's always been attempting to like position himself in some sort of, you know, authoritarian position or some power position, and he's always tried to kind of climb back up from what he believes he came from, that was, you know, rightfully his. He was supposed to be in line, and he was supposed to be part of that royal family, and then he lost all that. And so I think it's really what the greatest motivation in that character is to seek what he feels like he lost, and to seek out what he feels he lost. And so that's why he's always kind of vying for a power play, you know, to position himself with a winning team. And I think that's what he'll always attempt to do. Whether he'll be successful, I don't know. But, you know, the dangerous thing with playing these kind of characters is that if you live by the sword, you die by the sword. Mm-hmm. So he's got two ways to go. He's either going to succeed or he's going to die. Like, as far as I see it, like, these kind of characters, they're never going to just be content. You know, yeah. Everybody like, well, you know what, this is a pretty good job, there's a nice retirement package, and I think I'll just park it here for now.
Right.
No, it's all the way to the top, or like 6 feet under.
Well, let's hope he doesn't die.
Yeah, thank you.
Good question, thank you. Hey there, what's your name, what's your question?
My name's Antoine. My question is for you is, I just recently, just maybe like a month and a half, got onto the show. My wife's been watching it already, and I just kind of purged myself into it and just kind of caught up. And my big question is, are like you and Nick, the character Nick Care, are y'all can going back and forth with women? Cause y'all, both of y'all, I mean, Juliet and Adeline, it's like, what is going on, man? It's like, is that what they're bringing into the show? Cause y'all going back and forth.
Yeah, it's not like I haven't noticed. I think it's not like anyone hasn't noticed. I know it's kind of well, it's a good thing that you brought it up, because I do laugh about that sometimes with David. I'm like, am I like just determined to just ruin everything for you? Because you're right. It seems like there's this continuous love triangles with Nick and Renard and some other woman, and it's a very interesting soap opera that they've created for us, but it's not about to end anytime soon.
I just saw the last episode.
Dude, we had babies with the same woman.
Right. Crazy, man. I was just wondering if that's something that they're doing and when it's going to end.
I don't know, but God, that Nick is going to hate me.
Yeah.
Like,
yeah.
the end of the season, he's got so many reasons to hate me.
Right.
Yeah.
Okay.
Thanks.
Good question. Thank you. Hi there. What's your name and what's your question?
My name is Phoenix.
Hey, Phoenix.
So you said you do theater, and like I would like to do theater. I do it at my college right now, but it's super low key and a tech college, so there's not like if you show up, you get the part. So I was wondering like how you get over the stress and nerves of auditioning for like a thing that isn't just a college performance.
You mean like in theater or like
in theater.
On camera?
In theater.
You know, I thought, the thing I love about theater is that there really is more of a sense of community when it comes to theater. Not that there isn't in TV and film, but I think it's much more, you can't do theater on your own. But you can kind of perform in TV and film. I mean, on the day when you're performing, of course there's other people involved, but you are in your own trailer, you audition for the part on your own, it really is a lonely journey, a much lonelier journey, whereas theater, I feel like, especially in a town like Chicago, you could connect to the community, and you can work on so many different levels, and you could get involved in so many different projects, and you build a network of people who start to get to know you, and you keep auditioning for smaller independent things, larger things, you know, open calls, all this stuff. You make a lot of friends, you volunteer your time, you know, like to work perhaps and assisting other people raise a play. And so I feel like within a few years you can really build up a network and be part of the collective community of the city's theater community. And it's a lot more difficult in like TV and film to do that, you know. Generally the community is the people you've worked with and they become kind of your network. But so I think you have a lot more, control to some degree, because when I was doing theater, I was finding my own work all the time. I was calling up, you know, artistic directors, I was going into open calls, I was sending my resumes, and I was traveling around wherever I had to be to make the audition, and I felt a lot more in control of my own career in that way. There weren't any sort of, you know, levels of people and doors that I had to get through. Like, for instance, I can't run my own career in TV and film. I'm relying on my agent and a certain structure of the industry. So I think you're in a lot more position of power when you're pursuing theater.
Thank you.
Good question. Thank you. You know, it brings up a really interesting point. When you do theater and you do a long run, you could walk into a scene that you've done 10, 15, 100 times, and someone could give you something different, and you might have to pivot and do the scene the same way, but it will give it a different flow and shape. Have you ever walked into a scene on Grimm or something with, I'm gonna play it like this, and have it evolve by what somebody else gives you?
No, absolutely. I mean, at this point in time, you know, because we know the setup, and by setup, I mean really technical setup, like the room looks like this, I've been in this room 100 times, I know what the camera operators like to do, I know how they like to expedite the scene, I know what they're gonna need for me to just make their day. Because in TV, you're not the hero if you land an amazing performance. Like, you're not gonna like do some sort of amazing somersault and just land it, and like everyone's gonna go, oh my god, it was so worth waiting 4 hours for that. You know? But you're the hero if it's like, man, you got through that thing, you know all your lines, you knew exactly what we needed, and we made our day. Because we have so much to shoot every day. So, yeah, you kind of know how to assist them and expedite things. But occasionally, like when you really have something truly emotional and you have a good director who gives you the time, you get to play. And those are really amazing moments.
Yeah.
Those are really great moments because we don't get enough of those on television. Certainly not network television. Cable, you know,
right,
is a little different. But so those are moments that are really special because you can feel that they're giving you the time to explore and to play off the other actors, and we get some really talented actors. So it's those are great times, but they're not as frequent as you would think. Yeah.
Yeah. Hi, what's your name and what's your question?
My name is Shannon, and after Trouble Killed Juliet, that big oh my god moment, in the position of Captain Renard, who would you rather have, Nick or Trouble after you? Because you have so much backstory with Nick and all of this love triangles that keep going on.
Who would I rather have after me or by my side?
Who would you rather have trying to kill you?
Oh, trying to kill you.
Because you're going to go all dark.
Well, if I had to choose a nemesis, I don't know. I feel like perhaps I could deal with trouble more easily than I could with Nick, because Nick knows me a little too personally, and so he might know certain weaknesses of mine, where she doesn't know me, and she's kind of this young hothead that you could probably, I would feel as Renard, I could probably manipulate her easily, or easier. Yeah. Good. She's this little lunatic running with a machete. I mean, like, but she's great. I mean, I love Jacqueline. I love the character. But you know, like she comes across as this, you know, little you know, killer with a machete, basically, right, lopping off heads. So I feel like she's a little easier to maybe manipulate.
Good question. Thank you.
Thank you.
Don't let my name, Nick, scare you. All right, I got a kind of silly question.
Sure.
All right, backtracking to your other character, Sam Adama.
Uh-huh.
Now, you're probably pretty well aware that your pretty pivotal character leads up to the big Holocaust with the machines later on, because you were like,
oh,
your character
yes,
was
yes.
the one, though.
Of course, yeah.
Oh, let the genie out of the bottle. You're the one that said, kill.
Yeah, that's true. That's
How
true.
Does that make you feel?
That was actually a really, really cool scene. I, you're right. I never thought about that, but it was Sam who actually let them out of the cage, and so, yeah. In some ways, you're right. That was, oops.
it gave me a Godfather kind of feeling to that.
It was a cool scene, though, wasn't it? Yeah. I know he shows up with his little friend. Yeah.
Say hello to his little friend.
Good question. Thank you very much. Hey, Supergirl.
Hi there.
Hi.
My name is Marley.
Hi,
and
Marley.
I wanted to know why you like acting.
Why I like acting?
Good question.
Yeah, it's a good question. It's, you know, it's fun to pretend. You know, I think reality is a little hard sometimes. It's fun to pretend, and it's fun not to have to fully grow up to some extent, you know? Yeah, I think we get to just keep playing and keep pretending our whole lives, and isn't that fun? You like to pretend?
Yeah.
Yeah. So imagine doing that for a living. Isn't that fun?
Yeah.
Yeah, I think so.
Good question.
Thank you, Marley.
Thank you.
There you go. There you go.
Hi, my name's Yvette. How do
Hi
I follow
there.
That?
Hi, guys.
She's so cute. So, I have a silly question. First of all, we love you.
Thank you.
We love the show, Grimm. You said you came early to Chicago.
I did.
So, what have you done all week?
Oh, good question.
I got here on Thursday, and my brother came out to meet me, so we wanted to hang out and check out the town. We went out to eat, of course. We did a lot of, I did the architectural tour, a little boat tour.
Oh.
Which was, I highly recommend it. If you haven't done it in your own town, you should do it. Really, really great tour. And then we went to Steppenwolf to see a play. And last night we went to Second City to see some show. And then we went to see some blues last night. So, you know, I think we did pretty good. For, you know, 3 days.
Nicely
yeah.
done.
Yeah. Great, great city, though. I'm going to come back when it's tolerable weather. I like everyone was like, it's so balmy this winter.
Yeah.
Is it? This is not.
Is it balmy?
Yeah.
Is it?
Unbearable on that boat.
Good question. Thank you. You guys, that's the time we have.
Check out this guy's, which one is it? Bizarro?
Bizarro, my Bizarro comic. Check it out. Thanks,
yeah.
Kermit.
Cheers for Heath.